Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 276 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'll be continuing the series on the November 11, 2020 USMLE Step 2 CK changes that essentially began a few days ago. I mean, not a few days, that's December, whoops. Began about 3 weeks ago on the USMLEs. And this is series 6. Again, as I said, I've already made 5 podcasts, and I'm trying to follow the content outline put out by the USMLE pretty closely on this. So we've already talked about medication errors, we've talked about transition of care errors, we've talked about diagnostic errors, we've talked about palliative care, we've talked about ethics, we've talked about palliative care. Actually, there are 2 podcasts just on palliative care. So today I'm going to be spending a lot of time on professionalism and ethics. And, you know, this may be a multi-part series or maybe a one-part series, but let me just try and cover, because these things, when you're playing these podcasts, you're like, oh, this will only take 30 minutes. And then you say, like, whoa, this thing, I haven't even scratched half the surface. So I'll go for as long as I can and call it. If I can fit everything into one podcast, I will. If I can't, then I will just have to make another podcast or, you know, other podcasts. So let's go ahead and jump right into it, right? So ultimately, we know that with ethics and professionalism, the first thing you want to know is you want to know your 4 ethical principles, right? This is something that even before the USMLE made these changes, is something you need to know, right? These are things you need to know. So remember that the 4 main ethical principles, right? The first one is beneficence, right? So you always need to act in the best interest of your patient. You always need to act in the best interest of your patient, in the best interest of society, right? That's one important thing. The second one is non-maleficence, right? So you don't want to do any harm. The thing is, whenever you're doing ethics questions, if you think about ethics questions in these contexts, you usually end up picking out the right answer. Although I'll also give you a few more tips so that you don't make you don't make errors with these ethics questions. Ethics questions, again, I know they sound very difficult, but most of them are pretty straightforward if you know what you're doing. So non-maleficence, right? Again, you don't want to do any harm to the patient, right? And then the third one is autonomy, right? You always want to make respect the patient's autonomy, right? And then the next one is, final one is justice, right? So you're treating everyone equitably, regardless of their access to care or their socioeconomic status, things of that nature. Although there are exceptions to these rules, and your friends at the MBME, they love to test those exceptions, right? So essentially, again, if a patient makes a choice, you are bound to respect that choice. You're bound to respect that choice. You cannot be a paternalistic physician where you're like, oh, you know what? I know my patients have made these choices, but I'm going to override their preferences. I'm going to ignore their preferences. Even if it's beneficial to them, that is beyond you're not the patient's dad. So that is beyond your purview as a physician. There are some exceptions to that rule, though. Obviously, if a patient has like some kind of mental illness that clouds your judgment, or if it's an emergency situation, right, where the patient is like not responsive, cannot communicate what they want, then obviously in those circumstances you can take over as a physician and make choices that are beneficial to them. But if the patient is lucid, if the patient is completely with it, then you have no right as a physician to override the autonomy with regards to decision making. So again, as much as is possible, you always want to give your patients informed consent. Open the floor for them, give them everything they need, right? Tell them about their current. And the thing is, it's actually important when you're giving informed consent to know the different things that factor into appropriate informed consent, right? So obviously, right, you want to tell the patient, okay, this is what's going on. This is your status right now, right? So let's say before you do a procedure, you need to explain to them, okay, this is your status. This is your healthcare status. This is your healthcare status. And then you need to explain, why are you doing the intervention you're doing? Like, is it indicated? Do they really need the medical intervention that you're doing? Then you also need to communicate, what are the risks with that medical intervention? Again, all these things, I know like people in healthcare, sometimes they want to be in a hurry to get going with the procedure. But if you don't do these things and do it correctly, then a lawyer can always find holes to try to come after you in the future, right? So you need to explain the risks and the benefits of the procedure. You need to explain the other alternatives that are available, right? And then you also need to then give the patient your recommendations based on your best judgment, based on your knowledge of the appropriate clinical guidelines. And really, a lot of today's discussion, to be honest with you, is just me. I'll be throwing out a bunch of classic MBME scenarios, right, and what to do in those circumstances. Some of them will be quite unusual, but just kind of follow along and you'll get something from this podcast, right? So say, for example, let's say they give you a question about a patient, and this patient has COVID-19, and there's PPE available, there's N95 masks, there's everything that the physician needs to appropriately care for the patient. And then the patient, the physician says that no, that he doesn't want to be, he doesn't want to place himself at risk to his family or his significant other or whatever, and says because of that, even in the presence of PPE, that he cannot take care of the patient. That's ethically wrong, right? So the thing is, they love to do give this mantra with infectious disease. This is a great way they can throw in COVID on your test. In fact, to be honest with you, there are some other ways they can test COVID on your exam. They can make it a PTSD question, like a first responder or an ICU nurse with in a COVID unit. They can make a PTSD question from COVID. They can make a hydroxychloroquine question from COVID, right? Remember, Plaquenil causes a lot of problems, right? Can cause like cardiac problems and all that fun stuff. So those are ways they can test COVID. But yes, they love infectious diseases, right? And they love to set up these questions where the physician is like worried about contracting the disease, yada, yada, yada. It's not ethically appropriate for a physician to say, I'm not going to care for a patient because they have a particular kind of infectious disease. Obviously, if the appropriate infectious disease control measures or precautions are not available, so let's say there is no PPE or whatever, yes, the physician absolutely has the right to refuse caring for the patient. But if that equipment is available, the physician really has no rights, right, to deny. So like they love to do this with like people that have, again, like COVID-19, or they can give it a like a patient that has HIV/AIDS, or a person that has like some kind of hepatitis virus like Hep B or Hep C. Or they can make it a question about a person that has like the flu, or a question about a person that has like a multi-drug resistant organism like carbapenem resistant enterococcus, or like multi-drug resistant TB. Again, it is as long as you're taking the appropriate infection controller precautions and procedures, then you're ethically bound to treat said patient. Right. And then on that classic ethical scenario that may pop up on an exam is, let me give you a question about like having a close family member or close friend that, you know, needs care and you're caring for, and they're wondering if you can care for them in the hospital. In general, on MBME exams, avoid caring for family members. Right. The reason why you should not do that is you may not do things impartially. If you're caring for a family member, you may get an incomplete history. You may get an incomplete physical exam. Let's say the person has something where you need to do a rectal exam. It'll be kind of awkward for you to do a rectal exam on a family member, right? So you don't want to do that in those circumstances. And the thing is, you may also like things you would ordinarily not do for other people, you then begin to do for them, right? So let's say it's like a viral thing. And then you're like, oh, it's a family member. This drug is pretty harmless. Let's go ahead and give antibiotics, right? So the thing is, it's just really hard to give objective care when you're dealing with a family member. So that's why in general on MBME exams, caring for close family members, caring for close friends is probably not the most prudent thing to do in those circumstances, right? And then, should you ever have sexual relations with a patient? Absolutely not. You should not, right? So if you have a patient, especially if you have a current therapeutic relationship with a patient, do not have sex with those patients, right? You absolutely should not have sex with those patients. The thing is, there are some extreme situations, but again, these extreme situations are very few and far between, where let's say a physician really loves a patient and the patient really loves the physician. In some jurisdictions, in some circumstances, the appropriate thing you may want to do in those circumstances is first, like, speak with some colleague, speak with some other professional, break the therapeutic relationship with the patient first, and then wait for 6 months before you can start dating the patient. But again, I will encourage you to only choose that option if the option of just not engaging in any kind of personal relationships is not an answer, right? So in general, you should, it's very unethical, super unethical for a physician to have sexual relationships with current patients, right? And to be honest with you, even for cousins or like relatives of a patient you have, again, having sexual relationships with those people is not ethical, right? So again, the MBME, they are very good. Again, that's the thing that, you know, seems to be freaking a lot of people out with these newer exams. It's just some very bizarre ethics scenarios that pop up. So again, just something to be mindful of, right? Just something to be mindful of. Even it's not just the patient themselves, but their relatives. You cannot have sexual relations with the relatives of patients that you currently have. Okay, you cannot have sexual relations with those people. Another classic ethics scenario on an MBME exam is they may give you a question about a patient, and they may tell you that, you know, some guy, he comes in, you were chosen by some insurance company or whatever to do a disability evaluation, right? And the patient is trying to essentially coach you on how to fill out the disability claim forms. You need to do what is medically appropriate, so you cannot throwing something there that the patient does not have so that they can get more claims. Again, you're legally culpable if you do stuff like that, right? So you should never assist the patient in getting disability benefits fraudulently. That is absolutely unethical. That is super, super unprofessional for you as a physician. And then what if they give you a question about a patient and, you know, let's say this patient, and they'll usually make this a cultural question, if you may, right? So they give you a question about some patient and they tell you that, oh, this patient is from some country that is not the US. And, you know, it's some like cultural thing. And it's, let's say, like an 89-year-old female, and she has some kind of really bad serious illness, like lung cancer that has metastasized everywhere where there's no treatment option. And then let's say the family members of that patient say, oh, please, we would really want you to not tell grandma or whatever that she has XYZ condition. So whenever you get that kind of question on an MBME exam, typically the right answer to go with, I'll say like your first line answer in these circumstances, is you need to, in front of the patient and the family members, ask the patient, how much do they want to know? Does she wish to know the diagnosis, or does he wish to know the diagnosis, right? You need to ask the patient, because you can't just pick a blanket answer that says, don't disclose the information to the patient. No, you absolutely cannot do that, right? So you need to first clarify. Like many times on MBME exams, ethics questions have right answers where you're just gathering more information, or you're encouraging more conversation between the patient and the physician, right? So the thing is, you need to ask the patient if she wants. You can't just say, no, I'm going to disobey the family and go and tell the patient the diagnosis. No, right? Always be as open-ended as possible. Ask the patient, do you want to know the diagnosis? How much do you want to know, right? And whatever the patient states is what you're supposed to do, right? So if the patient says, I want to know the diagnosis, then it doesn't matter what the family members say. You need to tell the patient what's going on. But if the patient says, you know what, I don't want to know the diagnosis, but, you know, let my family members know, let them be the ones making decisions concerning my care, that's something that's known as authorized delegation. Okay, that is something known as authorized delegation. Authorized delegation. In those circumstances, yes, that's absolutely fine. You can then communicate decisions, communicate the diagnosis to family members and have them make decisions concerning the patient's care. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient, and let's say it's a patient where this patient has just been in lots and lots and lots of disagreement with you. The patient, you tell the patient to do XYZ, they don't do it. The patient is having like significant quarrels with you and all that fun stuff, right? I guess it's not fun for the physician. If you see all those kinds of things, is it appropriate for you to sever or break your relationship with those patients? So the thing is, this question is not simple, but there are certain things you should keep in mind as you're answering these questions. First things first, if the patient has a serious illness and they're not medically stable, you cannot chalk the patient off. You can't sever your relationship with that patient. No. If there is one thing you want to remember from all my discussion with concerning this specific scenario, is this: the patient has to be medically stable before you can then begin to sever relationships with them. That's one. So essentially, because this goes with this whole thing of non-maleficence, right? Doing no harm. If you break the patient-physician relationship, when the patient is like super, super sick and is at impending risk of death, right? That's actually something known as physician abandonment. And you could be sued. You are legally culpable in those circumstances. So the thing is, you know, if a patient is just not agreeing to your care and things are not working out between yourself and your patient, always try to pick the answer first that tries to repair that relationship. But if you've tried multiple times to repair the relationship and nothing is going super well, then in those circumstances, one is you yourself and the patient should mutually agree to sever the relationship. That's one. And two, you need to give them written notice. You literally need to give them written notice. Like, I think sometimes the many jurisdictions say up to 60 days, right? You need to give the patient written notice. And then if the patient is going, and you also need to provide some information on other physicians that may be able to take care of the patient, right? You need to provide information on other physicians that may be able to take care of the patient. And before you transfer the medical information to the other physician, like the patient's medical records to the other physician, you need to definitely make sure that you get some approval from the patient, right? You need to get patient approval before you can transfer any kind of medical record. Again, if you notice, today's discussion is just a lot of scenarios. Well, these scenarios are very high yield, very important scenarios to know for the purposes of your exam, right? And then what if they give you a question about your physician, you're like a resident or something like that, and you see another physician, and usually they will try to make it something where like the power balance is kind of off. So let's say it's a resident, and then he notices an attending physician that is impaired, right? That where there is like clear, obvious evidence in a question that, ooh, this person is impaired, this person is not with it, and they're trying to take care of patients. The right answer to pick on your exam, first things first, is to pick an answer where the physician involved is immediately removed from patient care, right? If they are currently in the ongoing process of, let's say they are doing a procedure like a surgery or something, you need to pick the answer where you're essentially removing that physician from patient care. And then you need to absolutely report to the appropriate authorities, right? So if it's like the division chief, if it's like the head of department, if it's the chair of department, if it's the medical board, you absolutely need to report. If you do not report and you've noticed, then guess what? You are legally culpable. Now, one thing I would say is you should not make these reports on MBM exams based on, oh, something you heard through the grapevine. Oh, you know, I heard from someone that XYZ physician was impaired doing XYZ, doing this and that. No, you cannot make reports on grapevine information, on hearsay. No, you only make reports on solid information, something that you directly observe yourself. That is absolutely important to know for purposes of exams, right? And then obviously, if you make an error, right, as a physician, you need to disclose the error, right? So you cannot just say, you cannot just try to brush over things, or maybe like start an intervention. Like, let's say you give a person like tons and tons and tons and tons of insulin, and then, you know, the patient's glucose did not tank, but you're like, you know what, let's just hang D5 and leave it at that. Without telling the patient anything, you absolutely cannot. Do not pick that answer on a test, right? On an exam, what you need to do is you need to disclose the error to the patient. That's the first thing you need to do. Two, you need to apologize for making the error. And then three, you need to tell the patient what you plan to do so that similar errors would not be made in the future, right? That's what you need to do on an MBM exam when you get those kinds of circumstances, right? When you get those kinds of circumstances. So again, you should not, even if it's something that does not harm the patient, you still need to disclose errors that you have made in caring for the patient. And then, what if they give you a question about a patient, and this patient came to see a physician, got some blood draws, and then the patient does not pay for the service, the patient does not present any insurance. Let's say, you know, the results of the tests are out and the patient is like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm not going to pay. I can't pay, blah, blah, but I need to know my medical information. What's going on? Do I have a XYZ disease or whatever? And then they'll say, what is the best physician response in this scenario? The thing is, you need to tell the patient the results of their tests. Okay, you need to tell the patient the results of their tests. You cannot say, oh, you know what, since you've not paid, I'm not going to give you the information on what we found out from your blood work or from your chest x-ray or some kind of imaging. You cannot. The medical records, especially the information in the medical record, is absolutely the information of the patient. They have full rights over that information, even if they've not paid for care. I know it kind of sounds bizarre. I know it kind of sounds unfair, but that's the right thing to do. That's the right thing to do on an MBM exam, right? And then, what if, in terms of patient confidentiality, what are some maybe key principles to keep in mind, right? So some key principles to keep in mind with patient confidentiality. Again, as much as is possible, you want to maintain patient confidentiality, right? But there are just some specific situations on MBM exams where maintaining patient confidentiality is superseded, right? You can't do those kinds of things, right? So what are some of these classic scenarios, right? So, for example, they can give you a question about a healthcare worker, right? And this healthcare worker has something that, or it can be a healthcare worker, or it can be a food worker, that has something that is transmittable, an infectious disease that's transmittable. So let's say the person has like Hep B. And again, they have to give you objective information in the question that the person, does in fact have Hep B, right? When you see something that is communicable and the person is working in a career where, like again, like a healthcare worker, it can be a medical student, it can be a food care worker, so like an employee at some like fast food restaurant, you need to disclose, right? You need to disclose. You need to disclose to the patient's employer. In that circumstance, pick the answer choice that involves disclosing to the employer of the patient, right? Another classic one is if a person has like a really bad infectious disease, right? Something like TB, for example, or a person has like really bad meningitis and they are wondering, oh, you know what? I don't want to get care. I want to return to work. I want to be able to care for my family. They'll make it like a situation where you'll be like, oh, I got to take care of the patient. Like, I mean, the patient has to take care of their family. Like, oh, you know, let me let this person go back to work. I won't tell anyone. No. Don't pick those answers, right? If a person has a really bad, super infectious disease like TB, like meningitis, then you need to disclose that information. You should not allow the patient to infect other people. In fact, many times on an MBM exam, the right answer to go with in those circumstances is to hold the patient against their will if need be, right? You can hold the patient in the hospital, right? You can pink slip the patient. Well, it kind of depends on what part of the country you are, but hold the patient against their will in those specific circumstances, right? Another classic one is an STI, right? So if a person has like a sexually transmitted infection, like trichomoniasis, for example, or HIV, and they're like, you know what? Please don't tell my partner. No. You need to tell the partner. The thing is, in general, you want to pick the answer that encourages the patient to tell the partner, right? But the thing is, even if the patient says they will tell their partner, they need to provide objective evidence in the question that the patient has actually informed the partner. If not, usually the right thing to do, regardless of what the patient says or not, is to actually inform the health department. You need to let the health department know. And then the health department, they will then be tasked with reaching out to the patient's partner or any close contacts of the patient that could potentially get infected. Another classic confidentiality scenario that they love to bring on exams is if a person has like something that can impair the ability to do certain things like drive, right? So it can be the person that has like really bad seizures or a person that has like really bad arrhythmias. Arrhythmias are something that for some reason, best students don't consider when preparing for these exams, but it's something you kind of need to watch out for, right? So if a person has like very severe arrhythmias, has really bad seizures, right? Those people should probably not be allowed to drive. So you need to report this information to the DMV, for example, the Department of Motor Vehicles, so that these patients are not given licenses or their licenses are suspended so that they're not able to drive. Because again, if you knew and then you didn't communicate the information, the patient drove and then killed someone in an accident, guess what? Or the patient even dies, guess what? Well, let's say like the patient is in an accident or the patient kills someone in an accident, guess what? You are legally culpable in those circumstances, right? You are super, super legally culpable in those circumstances, right? Now, looking at things from the other end of the curtain, right? Remember, if a person is underage, if they're less than 18 years old, most times you need to tell their parents what's going on with their health. You absolutely need to tell the parents what's going on with their health. So for example, let's say the child says, oh, I don't want to disclose this information and the child is under 18, well, I don't want to disclose this information to my parents. You can't. You need to disclose that information. And here's the thing. On the flip side, if the parents say, you know what? Wow, we know that our child has this. We don't want our child to know this diagnosis. In general, the right thing to do in those circumstances is to encourage the parents to tell the child the information. Or you can even ask the child a question like, what have your parents said about this? Right? Again, gathering more information answers are usually the correct answer on MBM exams with regards to ethical with regards to ethical circumstances, right? But if the parents say they don't want the child to know, then the child does not need to know, right? But again, usually they provide an answer where you're encouraging the parents to tell the child, or you're asking the child, what have your parents mentioned to you, right? So those are usually good answers to be in those circumstances. Now, one thing you need to be careful about though, if something concerns a mental health or reproductive health, and the child that's under 18 says, please, I don't want my parents to know, you should not tell the parents on an MBM exam. So things like birth control, or the child has like some mental health thing and the child doesn't want to disclose to the parents. Yes, you're allowed on an MBM exam to not disclose those things to the parents. Now, another thing I want to say, another classic scenario, and again, I'll begin to wrap this up pretty quickly here, is they can give you an ethical scenario where a physician is trying to refer a patient to like a facility where the physician actually like owns the facility or is like a partner in the facility. Basically, like in general, on an MBM exam, you should not pick answer choices that allow you to, that like, okay, let me tell you this. Essentially, on an MBM exam, don't refer patients to facilities where you have some kind of financial interest in that facility. That is ethically inappropriate on an MBM exam. And then, obviously, as a physician, right, you shouldn't pay some other physician to give you referrals, right? So let's say they love to make the situation where it's like they can give you like a gastroenterologist and some colorectal surgeon. And then the colorectal surgeon is paying the gastroenterologist to refer patients that have like polyps in the colon or colon cancer to refer them to this hospital. No, that's ethically inappropriate. You shouldn't do that on an MBM exam. And then in terms of like getting stuff from pharmaceutical companies, right, so that you can recommend their products, again, that's ethically inappropriate, right? So as a physician, as a resident, you should not accept payments from insurance companies or gifts from insurance companies or from like pharmaceutical companies to recommend a specific product to your patients. Again, that's ethically inappropriate. A lot of people unfortunately do that in healthcare, but again, it is not ethically appropriate on MBM exams. Again, remember, we're taking MBM exams here, so you don't want to do those things, right? And then one very challenging situation that pops up quite a bit on exams that you want to be wary of is a physician selling things out of their own practice, right? So let's say, for example, a physician is like selling stuff in their office, like selling like cosmetics, herbal supplements and all those things. Again, those things are ethically inappropriate on an MBM exam. You cannot sell herbal supplements as a physician. The only, like rejuvenating creams or whatever stuff, especially, and again, usually in the question, they'll make it pretty obvious that these things have not been medically proven or anything like that. You absolutely cannot sell those things out of your office. The only time you can sell stuff out of your office as a physician is if, for example, you live in a rural area and it's something that the community really needs and is not available anywhere else, right? So usually those things are like durable medical equipment, right? So like a DME, so stuff what are some classic things I can think about right off the cuff? Like those CPAP machines, for example, or crutches, things like that, or those motorized walkers that a person may, like an old person may use. Yes, you know, if you're the only game in town, rural area, you can sell those things out of your office. But again, all these like Fountain of Youth creams and all that stuff, you absolutely, absolutely, absolutely cannot sell that stuff as a physician, right? And the thing is, you also cannot, as a physician, make claims in a public space, right? On things that have not been medically proven, right? So it's almost like some company pays you to be like the face of their product, and I'm sure if you've watched TV, again, I'm not going to mention anyone's name, I'm not going to mention any specific program because I like to protect myself as well, and you know, I don't like trashing people or resources, but basically, right, like you can't come and be advertising like some supplement that has not been medically proven, has not been approved by the FDA, nothing, right? And then you're saying you make all these wild, bizarre claims, right? If you do those things, again, that is ethically inappropriate on an MBM exam, right? The thing is, to be honest with you, actually really supports the MBM in these moves towards more ethics questions, because these are things that pop up a lot in clinical practice, right? These are things that are actually a lot more useful to clinical practice than some question on some esoteric pathway that you probably will never use in anything that you're doing in real life, right? So again, just something you need to be mindful of. And then another thing I should also mention is it's actually perfectly fine for a physician to be an expert witness in a legal case, right? A physician can be an expert witness. But again, you shouldn't, like, if they give you a situation on the exam where the physician is an expert witness and the physician is making like tons and tons and tons of money from it, right? Then that is not ethically appropriate, right? Basically, you should compensate the physician only for what is like reasonable, right? They're just coming to give you unbiased testimony and that's it, right? And obviously, as a physician, you should not accept payments to come and testify on a person's behalf so that they can get off for a clinical case. I mean, for a criminal case where obviously they've done wrong, right? You absolutely cannot do those things. You absolutely cannot do those things on an NBM exam. And then another thing that they love to also throw on exams is they may give you situations where you're doing some kind of research study and it's for like a super, super expensive drug, right? And let's say you're the physician and you're the one administering the study. You cannot deny people access to the study. Like if a person wants to enroll and they're poor and you're like, this person probably won't be able to afford this medication in the future, or this person has a low socioeconomic status, so they shouldn't be allowed to enroll in this study, you absolutely cannot do that. Again, that's not ethically appropriate. Or let's say it's some study where just basically like it's a, like a justice principle. You cannot deny people access to research study based on their socioeconomic status or the amount of wealth that they have on an NBM exam. Again, that is just not appropriate. That is super, super not appropriate on an NBM exam, right? And then just kind of to recap here as I wrap up, right? There are some situations I've talked about in my early ethics podcast, right? Again, if a patient has a living will, in the palliative care podcast, if a patient has a living will, right, you need to do what the patient has already said in the living will, right? And classically, one thing they will love to do is they will love to, the patient has a living will and then the family members are like, no, we're not going to be able to do this. We don't want you to doing this. We don't want you doing that. We don't want you doing this. And many times on NBM exams, they will make the family members lawyers just to see if they can get you emotionally like shaken on the test. Once a patient has a living will, it's literally a contract between the patient and the physician. There's nothing that the family member can do. And I'm telling you this, the living will always hold up. They can threaten you all they want, sue you all the wazoo. They will usually not win those cases. Well, depends on the lawyer, I guess. That's a different conversation, right? But basically, you need to respect the living will, right? You need to respect the living will. Now, the thing is, if a patient does not have a living will, right? And let's say, for example, the family members say, because they love to throw in these corollary cases on exams, right? I mean, the NBM, they're very smart, right, with many of these things. So let's say they give you a question about some patient and, you know, the patient has no living will, patient is brought to the emergency room, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, the chances of them not making it are very high. And then the patient's families are like, you know what, let's let our loved one go in peace and all that stuff, right? The temptation, they will present two kinds of answers to you on the exam, right? One will be like, respect the family member's wishes and do X, Y, Z. And then another answer may say that you should try to gather more information from the family members or from close friends and colleagues about what the patient's wishes are. You definitely want to go with the second answer. You absolutely, absolutely, absolutely want to go for the second answer, right? Where you're gathering more information. Don't just acquiesce to whatever wishes the patient's family members have. No. You need to gather more information. Basically, the only situation where you should pick an answer where the patient's family members say, you know, just let our loved one go in peace, is when like they give you clear objective evidence in the question that even if the patient has no living will, they've already voiced that, you know, if they were in these really bad emergency circumstances where like the chance of survival is pretty much zero, that, you know, you should go ahead and do X, Y, Z, right? Like, oh, like communicated decision. So if they've communicated a decision to like someone else or something, I mean, you know, you can go ahead and pull the plug, right? But you need to be careful. You need to usually try to pick the answer that involves gathering some more information, right? And then another classic thing they do on exams, right? They can give you like a situation where a patient has like something that is really bad, where it's gonna kill them, right? But the patient does not want to be admitted to the hospital. The patient does not want care. So they can make this like the patient has like a PE and the patient says, you know what? I don't want to be admitted. I want to go home. And the patient is completely lucid. In those circumstances, guess what? You need to respect the wishes of the patient. You need to respect the patient's autonomy. Yes,
they're essentially doing themselves harm. But if the patient is lucid and they clearly communicate the decision to you, that you know what, I don't want to get treated, I don't want blah blah blah, blah. Then essentially what's going to happen is, typically, especially in the real world, you want them to sign an AMA form, right? So they are living against medical advice, they have it signed. We explain the, typically on the exam, you want to pick the answer where you explain the risks of them living against medical advice. Once they sign it, you can have them go home, right? You can have them go home. But again, if the patient is impaired for any reason, so let's say you're worried that this patient probably is not going to be able to drive home safely, so they may affect other people. Basically, once the patient's decision is affecting other people, you typically can override what the patient wants in those circumstances, right? So you typically can override what the patient wants in those circumstances. So again, these are just all things. I'm just trying to think of some other circumstance where, like, some weird circumstance they may throw in just based on my experience. Well, another one they can give is, they can give you a question about a patient that is on a ventilator, right? And this patient is, you know, the patient is lucid, the patient is with it. The patient says, I want to be disconnected from this ventilator. And they tell you in the question that, oh, if this patient is disconnected from the ventilator, the patient is going to die. If the patient is completely with it, the patient is completely lucid, and the patient says, yes, I absolutely, absolutely do not want to be on this ventilator anymore, then, again, don't pick the answer choice that involves, boom, acquiesce to what the patient wants. No. Again, try to pick that. It's almost like you are picking that, let me let this thing stew over kind of situation before you pick an answer, right? So what do I mean by that? So typically, right, what you want to do is you want to maybe, you know, try to gather more information from the patient. Like, why do you want to do this? Maybe gather more information from family members. Because again, if you pull the plug, the patient is going to die, right? So, but if you've done all those things and the patient is like, no, I want to be off the vent, then you take them off the vent and that's it. But again, usually that take them off the vent and that's it is usually not the right thing to do on an MBM exam. You'll almost always, I'm telling you this, and you may be like, Divine, these answers you're giving us are not very straightforward. Well, I'm trying to be as straightforward as possible, right? But the key thing I'll just tell you is, again, when you see those situations, try to gather more information. Try to put some time between when the patient requests it and when you're actually undergoing that intervention. And then if, for example, yeah, actually this would be a great example. Let's say they give you a question about a patient, and the patient has patient comes into the office and they're diagnosed with like some really bad disease, right? So let's say they're diagnosed with something like, trying to think of a really bad circumstance. Let's say like Huntington's, for example, right? Huntington's, right? And the patient is married, right? And the patient says, please don't tell my wife that I have Huntington's. And then they say, what is the best physician response in this circumstance? Let me tell you this right now. The right thing to do in those circumstances is to try to encourage the patient to tell the spouse. But if the patient does not want to tell the spouse, then unfortunately you need to tell the patient's spouse. You need to find a way to tell the patient's spouse, because guess what, right? Like, the patient's spouse needs to understand that if she has kids with said patient, they'll probably have kids that are gonna die, like, for sure in the future, right? And they will for sure get said genetic illness. So again, these just weird, bizarre, tenuous circumstances, these are things you want to be very fully well prepared for, especially if you're taking step one or you're taking step two CK. For sure, if you're taking step two CK, and for sure, if you're taking step one and also step three, right? I mean, step three, like the first day of step three is just a ton of bizarre ethical situations like this. So since this is kind of getting on 40 minutes, I'm going to go ahead and stop now. So thank you for listening. Please subscribe to the, if you're interested, I guess, let me talk about the Step 2 CK course. If you're interested, I have an MBME test taking strategies course taking place next Thursday from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. And a comprehensive Step 2 CK class. It's a 10-hour class, but it's 5 hours on Friday, the 11th of December, and on Saturday, the 12th of December. So if you're interested in any of those, and it's from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Mountain Standard Time on both days. So if you're interested in any of those things, feel free to reach out to me. Just give me a buzz or send me an email through the contact me button on the thing on the website, and I'll give you some more information on costing and you know, some more specific details of the course. And please subscribe to the YouTube channel. It's called Divine Intervention USMLE Podcasts and Videos. Subscribe to the podcast website, divineinterventionpodcast.com. And remember, I also have these podcasts on Apple Podcasts, on Google Play, and Google Podcasts, and on Spotify. So, you know, please subscribe. Any little bit of support definitely helps. So thank you for listening to me. Please pay attention to this podcast. Listen to it a lot before you take any of your USMLE exams. It will definitely come in handy for you. And also, like I said earlier in the beginning of the presentation, I have many other podcasts that I've made on these November 11, 2020 changes to the MBME. So thank you for listening. I'll see you next time. God bless you. Have a wonderful day.